From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the fourth day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. A bit later in the program, we'll talk with Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana, about the agricultural futures markets. Bruce Bostard will be here from the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company to take up the agricultural cash grain markets. We'll talk with Steve Hilberg of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center that belongs to NOAA about the agricultural weather forecast. Dave Dickey will take us through the agricultural news for the day. And then during the second half hour of our program, we call that the Farming World, Jim Hires of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank will be here to take up their good works. And Lisa Braltz will help us explore a much broader view of Illinois agriculture. It all happens right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
In Chicago on this Friday afternoon, futures finish the day like this. A lot of red there. July contract in the soft red winter wheat at $4.35¾, down 6 cents. September at $4.52¼, 7 lower. December at $4.83½, down 7¼. In Kansas City for the hard red, a loss of 6½ cents to settle at $4.65 on the harvest July month. Corn futures now in Chicago, $3.40, down 9½ in the July. September at $3.49¼, 10¼ lower. December at $3.59½, down 10¾, and the March at $3.72½, 11 cents lower. May futures of next year at $3.81½, down 11¼. July soybeans, $9.35, 20 lower. August contract at $9.18½, down 19¼. September at $9.05¾, down 20 cents. November beans, they stayed there at $9, down 19¾. And January futures, $9.10½, down 19 and three quarters for the day. July oats, $1.94, down 2. July bean meal at $2.77.20, down 6.80. July soybean oil today at $36.78, down 88 cents on the afternoon. CME Group livestock side, June live cattle futures, $90.95, down $1.15. August at $88.62½, $1.50 lower. August feeders at $108.87½, down 80 cents. September at $108.90, down 70 cents. And the June lean hog futures, $79.05, $1.40 lower. July contract at $79.72½, finished down $1.90. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. July crude oil futures at $70.97 a barrel, now down $3.64. The August at $72.30, down $3.75. July ethanol, $1.57, down 2½ cents. The natural gas at $4.79¾ on the lead option. It gained 10¾ of a cent. The heating oil down 8¼ at $1.95 even. And the gold futures at $1,216.20, $7.90 higher. Dow Jones Industrial Average below 10,000 at 9,934 points. Just about 322 points lower on the day. The U.S. dollar at 88.23 is up 1.09. The CRB index at 248.94, down 5.95. And the Goldman Sachs down 16 points at 473. Here's what the weather forecast for the Midwest looks like. It's calling for frequent showers and thunderstorms. That'll happen likely through next week. Daily rain amounts will be quite variable. Soil moisture should remain favorable through the next 10 days. Some 80 and lower 90 degree warmth is likely today and Saturday. Cooler Sunday with highs into the midweek lowering into the 70s and lower 80s. That followed by lows in the 50s and 60s overnight. High pressure ridge should progress from west to east across the region late next week and into the following weekend. That followed by stronger high pressure ridge that's possible around mid-month. We'll take a more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of this half hour and talk with Steve Hilberg. He's with the Midwestern Regional Climate Center that belongs to NOAA.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media on a Friday afternoon. We're joined by Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
2 weeks in a row, Todd. We can't take much more.
That's kind of a tough day. You know, the one number that I don't have and probably was the one that affected as much as anything, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, was the euro. Where did this thing go today?
Well, we went below 120 in the front end, and that was a big deal around mid-session, and it kind of just put the kibosh on any type of short covering in those outside markets. And so I think you hit it on the nose. If there was one thing that the traders before Europe closed up its equities markets, if there's one thing that they were going to be looking at, was how the euro closed when that happened, and it closed very, very poorly. And I think the French market was down around 3.5%, almost 4%. So we're mirroring that French market today with new lows in both crude oil and the stocks, even after the grains closed up shop.
Did you make note of what the news was that pushed the euro off the other end?
A couple things. Hungary is back in the news as a potential Greek-like scenario in terms of it's not being able to repay its debt, and that took hold of the markets. Probably more important to me was the Financial Times reported in the morning. The FTSE Global Bank Index was down about a little over 1%, and the overall move for the index itself was down about 6.5% for Société Générale. That's the French bank, that's a pretty doggone large bank over in France, supposedly and reportedly in trouble with derivatives positions. And so the trade kind of smelled that out as a potential repeat of what we had to go through a year and a half ago. And I think that probably started us off this morning. And we had one good shot, one good arrow in our quiver, and it was the jobs report, and it was not good. So that kind of sealed the deal. And then when the export sales came out for the week, we had a lot of negative mindset, you know, already in the market for feed grains especially, just kind of snowballed and magnified itself.
Now I was taking a look at the charts. Let's start with the corn. We thought things looked not so bad yesterday. Not so good today.
No, you know, it's really disappointing because yesterday we were only down about 9.75 cents coming into this morning's opening, and now we're going to be down over 20 cents, almost as bad as the wheat for the December futures, and now all of a sudden we're dealing with a sub-350 lead month market, and I think some of those technical swing objective bears, some of the Elliott Wave people that have been predicting 310 or 315 in the front-end July contract, as it goes off the board, they're going to have a lot more credibility in the market than they did a week ago.
And then just to stay with the charts very quickly, on the soy complex, let's see, I'm looking at the lead option daily chart. We posted an outside down day?
Yes. If you add together the overnight price action, the Globex
right.
price action, when we had a 9.58 1/4 high in the July beans, it did post on a composite basis an outside day down.
Now, that turns ugly, too. Otherwise, the bean chart doesn't look, I suppose, nearly as bad as the corn action for the day and the week.
No, I mean, we lost that 905 Custer line that I like to call is a good support. I didn't like seeing that at all. But I think, as a whole, the cash market in beans is something that the market will not be able to ignore too much as we get into next week. I think, generally speaking, this week, Todd, we had a situation develop where I kept asking myself, why would the corn be going down other than the good weather and other than the fact that we still had about 20% of the beans left to plant? Why would the corn be going down and the beans not? And I think it goes up to this new report that we're going to be getting next month. I really think the traders in Chicago and the investors as a whole came into the mindset by midweek this week that because the weather had turned for the corn and the warmth had come in, we were going to be looking at a much bigger yield assessment than USDA's 63.5 number that they gave us back in May. I think they're probably in the trade pricing in at this point the idea, especially with these corn getting down closer and closer to 350, going into this report with the idea that we're in the upper 160s and the carryover is going to go over 2 billion bushels on next week's report. Beans, though, they're nervous, I think, about the 190 carryover for the old crop actually being less because of how hard these beans are to come by.
Yeah, so let me go back to the corn, because the USDA number that's currently out there is above trend line. Do you think really that this is a possibility with this crop? I know it's a possibility, but how much of a possibility when they've already given us at USDA a better than trend line average for the national crop? Unless there are a lot of acres, I suppose, that are out there, and we'll find that out in the middle of at the end of this month. It seems like it's not as much of a possibility to put that much yield on the marketplace.
You know, we don't talk during the middle of the week, but I was hoping and praying you would ask this question because I did some research on that. What I have found out by clients all across the Corn Belt, whether Nebraska or Ohio, if you got the crop in by April 20th, you are looking at a near record yield, and that's what they're telling me almost universally. But if you're talking about after April 23rd, April 25th, something like that, you're looking at one of the roughest crops in the last 5 years. That's what they tell me. So I went back to the April 26th crop progress report, and we were 50% planted in corn as a United States. But if I look at the Three Eyes and Minnesota, we were at 68% planted on April 26th. So if I use that number and say 2/3 of the majority of the Corn Belt has a potential of a 170 yield, and the other 1/3 has a trend line yield potential of 158, then that puts me at about a 165 to 166 national yield. So you can't rule it out, is my answer to you, because of how much we had gotten done by the April 20th time period.
I'm glad to be at your service. You know, I was going to make a joke. Didn't you tell me about the Custer line last week? And I told you then that that didn't go so well for the general at that point.
And I still haven't read that part of history yet. That's how behind I am on my reading.
Okay, what else should we talk about before I let you go?
I think, again, to reiterate what is going on in this jobs market and the fact that the tie-in here for the agricultural producer is if you don't have the jobs in the creation of jobs, and you have, of all the jobs, of the 431,000 jobs created last month, 411,000 were census jobs. So you're not creating jobs. And if you don't create jobs, you're not creating consumption. Consumption is 70% of the GDP in this country. And if you don't have the U.S., China, and Europe running on at least 4 out of their 8 cylinders, and that's what the market's contending with now, then you go back to the commodity demand. You think, are we really going to be out of the woods by the middle of this year? And I think that's really what we're dealing with right now.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Have a great weekend, sir.
Hey, you too. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. Joins us from his Lafayette, Indiana office. Happens each and every Friday afternoon right here on the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Dave Dickey's here now. He has the Ag News for the afternoon.
In agricultural news, Russian officials today say that it is allowing other poultry suppliers to use a quarter of the U.S. 600,000-ton import quota after failing to come to terms with Washington over chlorine content in meat. A statement on the Industry and Trade Ministry's website says that a government commission approved the reallocation of 150,000 tons of poultry imports this year to any other supplier, country, or group of countries. Russia, U.S. poultry's biggest export market, banned supplies on January 19th, saying a chlorine wash used routinely in U.S. processing plants was in violation of its food safety standards. Finance chiefs of the group of 20 leading economies today are working to craft an agenda for keeping the global economy on track and fending off future crises. U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and other top finance ministers will set the agenda for a summit in Toronto later this month and years beyond. The leaders are searching consensus on how to reshape the global financial system and avert a double dip back into recession due to the European sovereign debt crisis. The finance ministers, who last met in Washington in April, are preparing a statement to be issued Saturday when their meeting ends. Tyson Foods Incorporated has settled a decade-long dispute with the Labor Department by agreeing to pay workers at poultry plants for time they spent putting on and taking off protective clothing. Under the agreement, the company will pay $500,000 in overtime back wages to nearly 3,000 workers at its Blountsville, Alabama plant. The Labor Department reached a similar agreement earlier this year with poultry processor Pilgrim's Pride Corporation. The Buenos Aires Grains Exchange today says that Argentina's 2009-2010 corn crop is estimated at 22.2 million metric tons, close to the record harvest 3 years ago due to bumper yields. With harvesting close to completion, the exchange raised its previous production forecast of 21.7 million metric tons, saying some of the crops that had been earmarked for animal feed would be turned over to commercial use due to their high quality. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey's Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. Dave, by the way, books that program. And if you have advice for him or me about the program, people you'd like us to interview, please do give us a call or email us. How about that one? It's willagstaff@illinois.edu. Dave also books our Commodity Week program. Our guest this evening will be Glenn Ring at Glenn Ring Enterprises. Commodity Week, it's our weekly look at what happened in the world of agricultural markets. Available up on our website at willag.org by about 6 o'clock each and every Friday evening. Now up next this morning, Fabian Fernandez stopped by my Mumford Hall studio to talk about micronutrients in cornfields. Apparently some of your cornfields are yellowed and stunted, maybe even have a purple streak or two in them. He says they'll grow out of it, and it's probably not a micronutrient problem.
Well, producers are seeing crops that are not growing as much as they would like to. Everyone was happy to see the crop planted early this year, but then the weather conditions turned a little bit unfavorable. And so they are seeing some plants looking a little bit pale, or some deficiencies, or what looks like a deficiency. And so they're wondering what to do about it.
Are we talking about pale and kind of yellow plants? Are we talking about purple streaks in these plants? What kinds of things?
We are talking about a little bit of a standing growth in some of them, so smaller plants. And then we are seeing some that look a little bit pale, some that look with streaks or different sorts of typical deficiencies that you would expect for different nutrients.
And in your mind, is that really the case?
Well, it is definitely looking like a deficiency, but it is a temporary effect, and it's related to the weather conditions that we had. The plants were growing, but not very fast. The root system is the first thing that really develops in these plants, and with wet conditions, a little bit cooler conditions, those root systems sometimes don't develop as quickly. And so now that the sun is out and the plants are really trying to grow, basically the root system is not able to meet the demands of that crop. And so that will be reverted as soon as the plant is able to put a little bit more energy into that root system. The root system will grow fine, and it will have all the nutrients that it needs.
How long will that take, do you think, before it disappears?
With the growing conditions that we are having right now, I would be surprised if we still see some of these things in a week from now.
All right. So the thing is, be patient, watch the crop, and see if it recovers. If it does, and I suppose trust your soil test.
Trust your soil test for some of the nutrients, for the macronutrients, phosphorus, potassium, most definitely. For some of the other nutrients, actually, a plant test is a better predictor of the need for additional fertilization.
Yeah, so but at this point, the plant's going to show it needs it, right?
That's right, yes. But if it continues on, if you see that these symptoms continue, then taking a plant sample of an area that is affected and another sample from an area that is not affected that doesn't show that deficiency, and taking it to a testing lab would be the best thing to do.
Fabian, you have heard just a bit from producers in continuous corn that it appears that they're having some nitrogen uptake problems. What are you finding out?
Well, yes, there are some of those deficiencies that we are seeing in the field this year are in continuous corn fields, and it's related to nitrogen. And that occurs typically if they have not applied their nitrogen or if they have not applied a full rate. Some people have seen this especially in anhydrous ammonia applied fields where that nitrogen is not yet completely available and compounded with the effect of the weather conditions that we were mentioning, it's creating some of these problems. So again, this will disappear as soon as the plant starts to grow into that band of nitrogen. And if you have not applied all of your nitrogen, doing a side dress application will definitely take care of that very quickly.
I'm going to make an educated guess that the anhydrous ammonia was side dressed in most of these cases.
That's right. Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Fabian, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Todd.
Fabian Fernandez is a soil fertility specialist with the University of Illinois Extension. You are listening to the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media on a Friday afternoon. It's time now to check in on the agricultural cash grain market. Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois, is with us. He serves as the general manager of the co-op's 10 elevators in Central and East Central Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
I bet farmers did not like the drop in the marketplace earlier in the week and liked it less today.
You know, 22 higher on beans yesterday was a lot more cheery day than down 20 today, that's for sure. Basis improved a couple cents on beans. A drop in the bucket doesn't do you much good against that kind of a downtick.
Yeah, they forget the 22 higher yesterday pretty quickly when faced with a 20 cent down, I suppose. Yeah. What do you see in total for a number of beans that are around that can actually be sold into the marketplace?
Oh, elevators have some left if the basis number gets right, so everybody's retained a little bit. Farmers, a few beans, too. In a way, maybe people are down to their gambling stocks, you know, where they've taken, you know, for an elevator, you've taken good basis gains out of most everything you have, but you have a train left or something like that.
Okay, then.
Just in case.
Then where are the beans? Where's the 190 carryover?
Scattered out in dibs and dabs everywhere. That's the thing is, I don't think you have huge amounts of beans anywhere, but everybody has a few. There's some ownership at the processors based a crush they have on. You know, you get this kind of a tight Terry out. The crusher doesn't want to own any beans that he doesn't have the sale on the other side.
Yeah, your bids for the day.
We are at 323 on nearby corn and 932 on beans.
Thanks much.
Thank you.
Bruce Bostard is the general manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. Joins us here in the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon. You can listen to him again on our website at willag.org. And don't forget, we put the numbers and some analysis up on our phone line, too, at 217-333-3434. Back in 2 minutes when we'll take a look at the agricultural weather forecast for a Friday afternoon.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the Labor Department today says that U.S. non-farm payrolls grew at their fastest pace in 10 years in May, buoyed by recruitment for the census, but private hiring slowed sharply as businesses opted to increase hours rather than hire new workers. Payrolls rose 431,000 as the government hired 411,000 workers to conduct the population count. Private employment, a barometer of labor market strength, increased just 41,000 after rising 218,000 in April. The average work week increased to 34.2 hours from 34.1 hours in April. Statistics Canada today says that Canada added 24,700 jobs in May, almost double the expected number, as the economy posted its fifth consecutive monthly increase in employment. The average hourly wage of permanent employees, watched by the Bank of Canada for signs of inflation, rose 2.7% in May from a year earlier, up from the 2.3% year-on-year increase recorded in April. And the European Union statistics agency Eurostat today says that the economy of the 16 countries that use the euro grew by 0.2% during the first quarter compared with the previous three-month period, despite another big drop in output in debt-laden Greece. And that's a look at today's business news.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's a Friday afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason. On the phone line with us, Steve Hilberg. He's the director of NOAA's Midwestern Regional Climate Center. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
Good to be here, Todd.
I'd like you to take a look back over the month of May. We just heard the soil fertility specialist from the University of Illinois, Fabian Fernandez, talk about some of the cooler weather slowing down growth of corn and making it show what would be a false positive for micronutrient and some macronutrient deficiencies. Can you tell me a bit about that cooler weather or how things slowed down?
Yeah, it was actually May was a real, a tale of two faces, I guess. Really, if you looked at the first half of the month and the second half of the month, they were completely different. First 15 days, the area from roughly Illinois on northwestward through Minnesota and the Dakotas was cooler than normal, and not by just a little bit. Through central Illinois, we ended up close to normal for the month, but it was anywhere from a degree to 6 degrees cooler than normal throughout the good northwestern half of the corn and soybean belt. South of the Ohio River, temperatures were near to slightly above normal. The second half of the month, basically from the 16th through the 31st, the entire region was above normal, and as much as 6 to 7 degrees above normal in Michigan and northern Wisconsin, but generally about 2 to 4 degrees above normal throughout the corn and soybean belt. So, yeah, we did have a big slowdown there in the first 2 weeks of May, but then we started making up for that the last 2 weeks with some pretty warm weather.
Are your expectations will be that we will continue to make up for losses and start to gain on them?
Yeah, we'll probably start to gain a little bit. I think next week we'll probably see temperatures a little closer to normal for a good part of the week, and then maybe a big warm-up by next weekend if the ridge moves into the central the upper-level ridge moves into the central Midwest, as it looks like it might. So I don't think we're in for any, at least not in the foreseeable future, for any drastically cooler weather. And so I think, and for the most part, we are in on a good trend right now.
And what's the weekend forecast look like?
Well, it's going to be an interesting weekend. You know, we have some showers and thunderstorms rolling across northern Illinois right now, basically along and just south of Interstate 80. They've been there off and on during the day today. But I think as the night goes on, and especially tomorrow looks interesting, we could have a pretty interesting possibility for severe weather tomorrow afternoon somewhere in the northern half of Illinois. Right now, the tendency tends to be for the northern third of Illinois getting the worst of it, if, in fact, it develops. But looks like it could be a pretty potent situation, and that could last into tomorrow night. Sunday looks like a nice day. We'll get a little bit of cooler, drier air in here. And for most of next week, we'll have northwesterly flow aloft, so we won't see anything exceptionally warm and probably a bit less humid. But as I said earlier, that the upper-level ridge starts to drift over the central U.S. By the end of next week, as it's now forecast to, we should see some nice warm weather.
Thanks much, Steve.
All right, Todd.
Steve Hilberg is the director of NOAA's Midwestern Regional Climate Center. This is Illinois Public Media. Stay with us for the farming world if you can.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, in today with Jim Hires. He's the executive director of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, located in Urbana. Thanks so much, Mr. Hires, for being with us. First, I suppose that we should tell folks that you and I have a working relationship because I sat on the board at the Eastern Illinois Food Bank.
Yes, you do. You're one of our 14 board members.
And speaking of 14, which 14 counties do we cover, or at least a broad range regionally anyway?
Well, we go all the way from Iroquois County in the north and Ford County all the way down to Clay County on the eastern side of the state. There are 14 counties that we cover. There are 8 food banks in the state of Illinois, and we've divided the state up in geographic regions. So that's our general area, about a little over 8,000 square miles.
And how many people use the services or the food bank? And maybe you ought to explain what the difference between a food bank and a food pantry is.
Well, a food bank is, in a simple explanation, is we're the people who put the food in food pantries, the soup in soup kitchens, and the snack in the snack programs. And in our particular 14 counties, approximately 103,000 different individuals use the service on an annual basis, and that boils down between 45 and 50,000 people a month to visit the food pantries, and then we count meals separately from that.
And so how many meals do you think are being served?
There are about 120,000 meals per month served in the 14 counties.
That's a lot.
Those are in shelters and soup kitchens.
That's a number of meals. Can you tell me about food insecurity and what that means in your business?
Food insecurities are individuals who at any given time have to make a decision about either having another activity, paying a bill, paying a medical bill, utility bill, car payment, transportation, and buying food. Other definition is that on any given time, they may not know if they're going to have enough food to last for the next day or so for themselves or their family.
These are important things and you operate the food bank as a business, so they're sort of important things to know to get an idea of how much you need to have in the warehouse. And maybe you can talk about the warehouse and the storage and food collection and fundraising and those sorts of things as well.
Well, our warehouse is a 40,000 square foot warehouse located in Urbana. We've had this particular warehouse since 2004, I'm sorry. And before that, we were located in a much smaller facility near downtown Urbana, Illinois. Our warehouse is normally stocked between 600 and 1,000 and a million pounds of food at any given time because we turn our warehouse over about 7.5 times a year. And we'd like to have a month's supply in the warehouse at any given time. It'd be cool if we had a little bit more, then that's about 600,000 pounds on a regular basis we'd like to have in inventory in case something would happen in terms of the supply chain and we would be able to still service our pantries and soup kitchens. That food comes from a variety of sources, as you well know, as we've talked about in other previous interviews, but it is primarily comes from three places, donated food, and we'll talk about donated as we discuss where food comes from, purchased food, and then USDA commodities.
Well, let's start with the donated food. Where does it come from?
Our donated food comes primarily from manufacturers, wholesalers, and large distributors of food. People do conduct food drives for us, and they're a very, very important aspect of what we do to get the message out about hunger. But the primary source for donated food are those manufacturers and distributors. Manufacturers such as Kraft and Nabisco, Conagra, Campbell Soup, Kellogg's, General Mills, those type of companies. And then we belong to the network of 206 food banks around the country, and we have a system where we go online almost a daily basis, and we move food around the country, and that food is donated from various areas where they have surpluses, and we have access to that as well. In addition to that, we use locally donated food through pickups with all of our Walmarts, Sam's, other grocery stores such as Schnucks, County Market, Target, and then through a major wholesale produce company called W. Newell, which we get a great deal of produce from. That's the donated side.
Yeah, on the donated side, so tell me a bit about what has happened over the last 10 years as the companies, the Crafts of the world, the ConAgras of the world have gotten better at their job. And the donated food is often things that are perfectly fine food, but they're off weight. Packaging is wrong. What's happened in the last 10 years that's changed the amount of donated food that comes from these types of companies?
Well, when you go to the grocery store, people scan a little card that they've been given to the major supermarket, and they tie that to sales, et cetera, et cetera. But primarily that's used for inventory control. Years ago, I always like to use Kraft as an example there, since they're local. If Kraft would manufacture 25 million cases, for example, of mac and cheese, with the hope of selling 25 million cases, now they know through those scanning devices just what stores can move, how they're moving it, and they do more online production or on-time production. So those excess quantities are not available. And most manufacturers have done that. And that's been a big, big, big change. The other thing is quality control in the manufacturing sector. If you were in the manufacturing business, your job would, one of your jobs would be to keep waste down to a minimum. And these companies have gotten much, much better at food handling, labeling, so they don't make the mistakes that used to, that we used to be able to get. That's the biggest change.
Yeah, so that's the big change, and it meant that there is less that would be coming into the food bank.
Right, and it's not because those individual companies and organizations don't want to contribute. Is they're doing their job by being efficient and keeping their costs down. And so you can't get upset with the business model. That's what they're in business for. But that's made us have to be a little more creative.
We've had to be more creative. And one of the things that the Eastern Illinois Food Bank has tried to be creative about is the types of products that are in stock. You prefer to have, if you can get that, these types of products anyway, nutritionally, what you call nutritionally dense products. Why is that the case, and what do you aim to be able to get into the warehouse?
Well, when you look at food insecurity, most of the time people just don't have enough to eat. And I think that it's an important thing to remember that we have really two missions when we provide emergency food. One is to fill people up. And secondly is to try to provide food that is nutritionally dense, that is not just wasted calories. We can get a lot of carbohydrates. It's hard to get protein. Protein being meat and those kinds of things donated. And they're very, very expensive to purchase, so it's easier to purchase and to get donated less nutritious food than we could purchase. So we made a commitment, our board did, about 4 or 5 years ago to improve the quality of the food that we do send to our pantries. That has necessitated us having a vigorous purchase food program and raising funds to do that. But we also believe that it's important that the quality of food be there. It's a balance that we have to go through. And I tell my staff, I said, if we have to make a choice, we're going to feed people. But we're going to try to do it with nutritionally dense food when possible.
And how do you do that?
Primarily through our purchase program. We have a very aggressive purchase food program. It started about 11 years ago when the board at that time had foresight to know that we're going to have to make up where we can't get food through this process, and we have developed that into a very, very, very good business model where we can buy food on the wholesaler market very much like a grocer would buy it. And we pool our resources through the State Association, Feeding Illinois, and the other eight food banks to buy in large quantities so that our costs are very minimal, because our food pantries do have to pay for the cost of that food so that we can stay in business, obviously.
And so what it all means is that, and maybe we can use pounds as opposed to dollars, but the food bank is capable of parlaying what would be the cost of 1 pound of food into about 10 pounds of food instead? Is that right?
If you give it as a dollar, we can parlay that into about $10 worth of food. And the retail value of food that we get is right now listed at about $1.50 a pound. That's the average kind of thing through a food bank. So we're able to parlay our dollar basically because of the interconnection and the networking with all the other food banks around the country.
We're talking with an audience primarily this afternoon of agriculturalists, probably some that raise both corn and soybeans, almost all of them, but also that might be producers of beef cattle or hogs or goats and sheep. They might also have vegetables on their farms. How might they go about donating to the food pantry, and what kinds of facilities do you have on hand that can help them with that? Do we have transportation? Or do we have the ability to do refrigerated and freezer products? What kinds of things might a producer be able to do with the food bank, and are there advantages for them? And I guess I suppose beyond feeling good, I'm thinking about tax advantages.
Let me start with those farmers who primarily raise commodity products such as corn and soybeans. We have a relationship with the Illinois Pork Producers Association. We made through that relationship is through the Food Bank Association, now called Feeding Illinois, and they've been partners with us for about the last 3 years, along with the Illinois corn producers, to provide ground pork to the food banks around the state, and these are donated by operators, and then they're processed through various meat processors across the state who belong to an association of those groups, and that's paid for by the corn producers. So we now have a history with producers, and we're trying to obviously develop that further with the beef producers, and of course we do have one with the egg producers in the state as well. So even though farmers indicate I don't necessarily raise vegetables, there is a connection between the land and the people in Illinois, and we're very, very aware of that. Into the local production of fresh produce, we would prefer to have Illinois fresh produce all the time if we could get it in the quantities that we can get it. And to that end, we do work with the local area farmers on doing pickups, and of course our Plant a Row program with Master Gardeners has been an active part of what we've done over the years. We pick up at the farmer's market at the end of each Saturday anything that's left, and then of course we get produce through our affiliation with Produce Warehouse. And then we will buy produce through the Food Bank Association if we can get that at a good quantity. The Feeding Illinois' commitment is to do as much of that in-state as we possibly can. And I think over time we will get better at that. Our facility can handle frozen and fresh product. We have a system for produce distribution that is just remarkable in how fast we can get that out to agencies. And that has made a big, big difference in terms of being able to handle the produce. We'll move between 600 and 850,000 pounds of produce this next year. We would love to handle 1 million pounds a year.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Hires, Executive Director for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. This is the Farming World, a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason.
It's National Frozen Yogurt Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1845, Hatch's sowing machine for wheat, oats, and other grasses was first demonstrated. The machine could sow up to 25 acres a day, and it cost just $40. In 1872, Robert Cheesbrough of New York patented a method for making Vaseline. In 1895, African-American inventor Joseph Lee patented a machine for bread crumbing. It was intended for use by restaurants to crumb large quantities of bread scraps. In 1907, the automatic washer and dryer were introduced. And in 1936, Sylvan Goldman invented the shopping cart. He got the idea from a wooden folding chair. Wheels are placed where the bottom of the chair legs were, and in place of the chair seat, Goldman stacked two metal baskets on top of each other. At first, customers were reluctant to use the new contraption, so Goldman hired fake shoppers so customers could see just how useful the new cart could be. A few years later, Goldman came up with the shopping cart nesting design that is still in use today. And that's this day in agricultural history. Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Most of what you hear on the farming world revolves around production agriculture. After all, Illinois ranks second in the nation in both corn and soybean production, and is number three when it comes to agricultural exports of all kinds. But agriculturally speaking, there's a lot more going on in Illinois than just row crops. From vegetable gardens to wine and beer making to microagriculture to floriculture, the state is full of agricultural stories worth taking a closer look at. And that's what we're going to do most every Friday at this time. Lisa Braltz lives in East Urbana, where food and neighborhood projects go hand in hand. She'll be exploring agricultural practices and possibilities in her weekly feature, In My Backyard.
So the nature of the work that I do, which is primarily managing a large farmer's market in East Central Illinois, requires that I get out into the Illinois countryside and visit some of the farms that sell fruit and vegetables at the market. So each spring and summer, I hit the road. Here's something I've noticed on my travels. Small-scale fruit and vegetable agriculture is just not very visible in Illinois. When you're on the interstates, you don't see the smaller farms, which are most often only findable when you get off at the next exit, then take the first right, drive 8 miles, then take the left by the graveyard. When the main roads, the interstates and county roads, bisect farmland in Illinois, it's most often land on large farms, farms with hundreds or even thousands of acres, growing primarily corn and beans and maybe some wheat or oats. These large farms are hard to miss. They take up the most acreage and have enormous, exotic-looking machinery working out in the fields and driving on the back roads. I thought about this as I drove along 57 and 72 and 74. I thought about the small farmers who grow fruits and vegetables for farmers' markets and other outlets, and I thought about their tractors and planters and greenhouses and farmhands, and I thought about how those things bore no resemblance whatsoever to what I was seeing all around me along the interstates. It really struck me. The most visually apparent agriculture in our area involves food we don't eat directly after harvest, though many of us eat animals that eat these foods and products made from these foods. When we think about farms, we usually envision a pastoral farm scene with hills and cows dotting the landscape. But what we see while we travel to Chicago or Springfield or Carbondale, like the t-shirt made by a local artist says, corn and beans and corn, variety is the spice of life. Despite the humor, we all know that the commodity crops that are grown here are, without a doubt, a massive, massive part of our state's current food system and economy. They literally dominate the landscape. But what about the agricultural activity that lives in Big Ag's shadow, the parts we don't see from the interstate? Let's talk about local fruit and vegetable production. Just over a year ago, state legislators learned from the Illinois Local and Organic Food and Farm Task Force that, despite Illinois' reputation as an agricultural state, the vast majority of the food we eat, over 90%, is imported from other states and countries. And it's not just happening in our state either. When the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University recently looked at the potential for increased fruit and vegetable production in six Midwestern states, including Illinois, they concluded that just under 300,000 cropland acres would be required to provide the partial year fruit and vegetable needs for all six of those states. That area is the equivalent to the average amount of cropland in one of Iowa's 99 counties. It stands to reason, then, that we could have the best of both worlds in Illinois. We can enjoy the social, economic, and other benefits from increased smaller-scale fruit and vegetable agriculture, as well as the huge yields of production agriculture. I mean, food's a pretty big tent, and everyone eats. Why not eat food that was grown here since it grows so well? After all, one of our state's most awesome resources benefits even those of us trying to coax just a few things out of the ground, some of the best soil in the world for growing food. To that end, let's talk about local, as in really local, food production by what I call micro-producers. Everyone from folks who have a few tomato plants on their patio to folks who plant huge gardens on vacant lots. These are the people who try to grow whatever food they can, wherever they can. Micro-production can better connect the community with food by fostering closer relationships between growers, large and small, and eaters. Relationships that encourage conversation not just about growing food, but also about food preparation and preservation, arts that are slowly becoming lost. Engaging eaters, especially young ones, in microproduction can encourage a better understanding of the work and the resources it takes to produce food. And creating friendly, convivial environments around microproduction that encourage people to get together, to teach and learn new things, and to get their hands dirty, whether it's in a yard or in the kitchen, yields far more than just vegetables or meals. I keep thinking about the immediate impact of what each of us does at home and in our neighborhoods and towns. I know from experience and seeing it happen again and again that watching someone build a garden or plant a seed or make yogurt or bake bread can get a person thinking, hey, maybe I can do that. It's this important work that isn't visible from those main roads, the interstates. It's happening in our own backyards.
Lisa Brock's stories can also be heard on our website at willag.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com.
Thanks for listening to The Farming World. If you have comments, please do send us a note at willagstaff@illinois.edu. The Farming World is a production of Illinois Public Media.